Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land and culture and agriculture in the state, where it's come from and to where it's going. In this program, we will look at the results of the mixing of cultures in the New Mexico bioregion and how it has affected the use of land and water and what that's meant for culture. Ernie Atencio explains how the period of Americanization changed the land base of the Indios Fanon population that resided alongside the native nations in what was Mexican territory.
Yeah, the history, part of the belonging to northern New Mexico is the fact that when Indo-Hispanos first settled around northern New Mexico, they could make an application to the crown in Spain for a grant of land for a community of people. There were a few private land grants that were made for various reasons, but a lot of them were community land grants. And it's a kind of land tenure and land ownership that I think most Americans are not so familiar with. But the idea was that people would make an application for a piece of land, and it would include certain areas where they would have their homes and small sort of kitchen gardens and farms and pastures for some of their animals, but then a huge vast area, like say an entire watershed, for grazing, for timber, so they could more easily control the source of their irrigation water in the acequia. And these common lands were called ejidos. And I guess there's some parallel between an ejido and what we would call public land these days, except these were not open to the general public. And they were not necessarily for recreation, but they were the resource base for the community. After the U.S. annexed this area, they went through a process to review and confirm all those land grants, because it was part of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo that the U.S. had with Mexico, that they would honor all standing private property ownership rights. The way the U.S. approached it was that people had to prove their ownership rather than the U.S. defending people who already owned land. These were, for the most part, very poor, uneducated people, certainly not educated in the American system of law in English, with a whole different set, a whole different idea of land tenure, land ownership. So a lot of these people lost their lands. The ejidos were lost. Something like 80% of the ejidos in northern New Mexico were lost through this process. And a lot of those lands then, in the early part of, I think it was 1905, something like that, were deemed public domain by Theodore Roosevelt, which became Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service lands. So it seems to me, you know, there have been a few attempts, and I think there's still some action going on in Congress to find some way to rectify that situation. I don't know if it's going to come to people actually having the land returned to them, which is a pretty tough thing to imagine. And I know an awful lot of organizations would have sworn that they would fight that tooth and nail. But it seems to me the real loss was the loss of opportunity, not so much land. The loss of access to resources and the loss of opportunity, the loss of access to capital that you would have if you owned land. Since then, these communities in rural northern New Mexico have been just some of the poorest anywhere in the U.S. And I'm sure, I'm not an economist, I'm sure there's a direct link to the fact that they lost the land base. They lost the resource base. So I don't know if returning the land would necessarily be the right thing. I have a rancher friend who says to him it's more important how the land is managed and who has access to the land and how it's cared for. That's more important than who actually owns it. Or he says, first let's learn how to take care of the land. Then we can argue about who owns it, because nobody's doing a really good job of taking care of the land these days. There have been some other ideas floated around about establishing trust funds for land grant heirs, having subsidies for locally based economic development opportunities, having scholarships for land grant heir kids who are trying to get an education. And again, it comes down to providing the opportunity that was stripped away by the loss of those lands. So there it is. I think it's pretty difficult to go backward in terms of returning those lands to a different ownership. But who knows? It'd be an interesting experiment. The Forest Service certainly hasn't been the best land steward in the world, and the BLM oftentimes hasn't been either. So it'd be interesting to see what happens if some of these lands were returned to land-grant heirs, if nothing else, just as an experiment to see if they were managed any better.
New Mexico State historian Dr. John Hunter explains how the Newlands Act of 1902, which opened the West to be irrigated, changed the southern part of the state.
Now, the Newlands Act is like plumbing the rivers of the West. It's like at Elephant Butte Dam, just think of it as a big bathtub. They release it and the water goes down the Rio Grande and goes in, and then they close that up and it starts filling up again. And the water season, again, depending on the spring runoff and the water that's impounded at Elephant Butte, runs from about mid-April to mid-October. It transformed the crops that were grown. There were a lot of crops that were grown here. Farmers, except for years of drought, had a pretty good growing season here. Elephant Butte permitted water to be released through the growing season and also permitted thirsty crops like cotton, like pecan trees, to thrive here. So it changed what was grown here. And this is, of course, for market. We ship pecans throughout the world. We ship cotton throughout the world. So that there's a lot of crops that weren't able to before. Now, also, EBID releases water to residences as well. So about every 3 weeks, those houses that have EBID water rights are able to flood their lawns and their fields with water for about 2 days. So they just flood them, turn on, flood it, and turn it off. So that helps to make this part of the state an oasis as well.
But agriculture has also changed in terms of its way it's done. And that comes from the construction of dams. The U.S. government constructed several dams here in the early 1900s to impound the water and encourage farmers to use irrigation systems that were developed as a result of those dams. Whereas before, the Zunis relied on rain-fed irrigation systems or runoff irrigation systems and dryland farming systems. Some fields were irrigated from springs, and some fields, of course, were irrigated from wells, things like that. But the movement towards large dams caused a big change.
With every action, there will be an opposite reaction. That is to say, you can't do one thing without affecting another. Jim Enote from the Zuni Pueblo explains how the Newlands Act and the damming of water around the West affected agriculture in his traditional community.
The U.S. government, once they set up these dams and irrigation systems, basically what they were saying was our methods of farming were inefficient and primitive. And so, yeah, so the dams would be built to impound water and be more efficient. When they did these, they also set up irrigation districts and allotted male heads of households portions or parcels to irrigate. And this caused some problems because ours is a matriarchal, matrilineal society where women normally or traditionally are the owners of lands and properties and other things like that. So that caused some confusion. It also told Zuni farmers that, well, unless you have irrigated lands, there's no sense in farming. It's just not worth your time. So things have changed because in my great-grandparents' generation, my great-grandfather was very good at farming, did some dry land farming and also irrigated from springs. My grandfather's generation came around the time when he was educated by government agricultural agents who may have had good intentions but told them that to really be an efficient farmer, the only way to do that was by irrigating from these reservoirs. So he felt that, well, we don't have fields that are near those irrigation districts, so why bother? And he stopped farming and took up raising sheep instead. My father's generation, definitely they were like, well, if we don't have irrigation water from reservoirs to use, then why bother? And in my generation, the reservoirs started to silt up because, of course, reservoirs have a limited life where they're efficient or, I guess, where they can be used. So they silted up and there wasn't really much water left in them, or there isn't much water left in them. Some Zuni farmers were just saying, well, very discouraged, saying, well, we don't have effective, efficient dams anymore, so why bother irrigating? And why bother farming? But now there's a resurgence, I think, in the last 20 years for sure. The reservoirs, of course, changed the geomorphology, changed the whole landscape of many of these valleys a lot because, first of all, several of the reservoirs failed after they were constructed. they were built, and then they failed. And then when they failed or broke, the water that rushed out caused a lot of erosion. And some of that erosion created a kind of a head cutting throughout the watersheds. This erosion through the watersheds then damaged dryland agricultural fields and also the rain-fed and runoff agricultural fields. So people who once relied on runoff in valleys or alluvial fans, those were damaged because of the reservoirs that broke. And so they were unable to use those really good prime runoff agricultural and dryland agricultural fields or lands anymore. I think the other part that plays into this is, well, obviously the marketplace, you know, as I said, but it's for some people, now that we have market economies and value as labor, you do your arts and crafts, or you go to work for the schools, or you work wherever you do work, and you get a paycheck, and then you go to the store and buy your food. The other part that plays into that is the media, of course, television, radio, all sorts of things that advertise foods. And they seem cheap in comparison to the time that it takes you to go out and grow your own food. But I think there's more to growing food in agriculture than just finding a good bargain by, you know, finding cheap food.
Dr. Maria Mondragon Valdez, historian from the San Luis Valley in southern Colorado, in the New Mexico bioregion, explained that after the U.S. occupations of Mexican lands, land speculators from as far away as Amsterdam began to divide land and sell it, decreasing the land base of the settlers. She also explained how the modern seizure of common lands affected the community of San Luis on the Upper Rio Grande.
After World War II in the 1960s, the Rio Riba lost a significant population because of land losses, and in Costilla County, we're emblematic of that. We had the largest out-migration of population in 1960, and that correlated with the fencing and the barricading of the last open lands in upland area in Costilla County, and it was known later on as the Taylor Ranch, and now it's owned by a private corporation from Texas. But this ejido, or upland commons, which was land that was granted in 1863 by a covenant by the original landowner to use but not to own, to have usufructuary rights, rights to access resources but not to own those resources. When that was closed off in 1960, the sheep population went into a steep decline, and there was a large out-migration of individuals from Costilla County. We were already on the edge since the 1930s. And actually, since the land companies took control of the resources beginning at the beginning of the 20th century, for sure, by 1913, land was in control of the land company, and they went after all of the common lands, and the community became, instead of being subsistence, self-reliant farmers, they became laborers for the large ranchers and for the large farmers. And so that was a big change in the community as related to a challenge to these traditional land use patterns and to the traditional rights of the community. And so in the 60s, the Rio Riba erupted. And it wasn't only in New Mexico. This happened in Costilla County, and people rebelled against the enclosure of open space that was previously communal space. It's really difficult to live in a situation where you see land all around you, but there's no public space, no open space. And the only thing we have now is we have some access to that uplands, but a contemporary outcome of this court ruling, and it's the underbelly, and it's, as they say, the devil is in the details. And what ended up happening in Costilla County is now some subdivisions have also have access rights to that upland. So it's not just the local people, but it's people that are absentee resident landowners that now have access rights to that uplands. And that's because Colorado's notions of private property are sacrosanct. And so the old communal land tenure patterns of the land grants have fallen by the wayside. And so there is not communal land. And that was what was the kind of the post-Guadalupe Hidalgo legacy. and the kind of defining mode of existence in this frontier area was to have access to the uplands, because that's how people were maintaining their subsistence level, and having small farm plots and living at subsistence levels. It was a hard life. I'm not trying to romanticize it and saying that things were perfect. I mean, these communities had no doctors in them. They were using a lot of the traditions that they learned from the nomadic tribes and from the Pueblos. They were growing the same kind of subsistence crops. They were using the same herbs. They were mixed-blood mestizo communities. But as soon as the American period came in, and the defining moment was the railroad, because the railroad really industrialized the land and changed the landscape and changed it from a frontier uplands into a commercialized periphery of the Front Range of Colorado and the gold mines of Colorado, and also a resource for the military to subsist in this area. Without the rural communities of the Rio Reba, the northern New Mexico counties, the military would have not got fed. So these communities were the foundation. But once all of that coalesced and it was industrialized, then the communities became marginalized and subservient to newcomers that came in that really had no empathy for their position. And then they ended up becoming the low-income labor force that worked on the big ranches and the big farms. And definitely by the 30s, the communities were impoverished.
Ernie Atencio from Taos Land Trust explains how the people used and continue to use common lands.
Some of the rural mountain villages around this area that still rely on firewood, not just for heat, but also for cooking. So that's not an old bucolic historic thing. That's still very current. People need that. When there was an injunction because of spotted owl lawsuits back in the mid-90s, an injunction that stopped all cutting, including firewood gathering on national forests, a lot of people in the community of Truchas, as one example, didn't have enough firewood, and they had a long, cold winter. So there's firewood, they're building materials for homes. And in northern New Mexico, what used to be just the cheapest type of building, using mud and making bricks out of it into adobes and using small diameter trees for vigas and latillas, people built like that because it was effective and because it was cheap, and these were all resources that were on hand. So those are some other resources that come from the local landscape. Grazing livestock. They have sheep or cattle or a lot of those. Traditionally, those herds and flocks would graze and be moved in a transhumance kind of way up and down with the seasons to wherever the most nutritious forage and grass was. Hunting as well, because people relied also on hunting. And I think a very, very important kind of big picture resource is just watershed, the watershed health. Because that's where the water comes from for your acequias, your irrigation water. If you overcut your forest, you ruin your watershed. You're going to have too much silt and sediment clogging up the head gates and causing troubles. So people had to, you know, as part of the reciprocal relationship, take care of the land by not overcutting the forest, by grazing carefully and seasonally in the right places at the right times to care for the watershed so you've got that water when you need it. As well as the land that was farmed, there were a lot of wild foods that were gathered throughout different elevations on the mountainside, and a lot of those foods grew along the acequias and ditches. So just a whole range of resources.
Dr. Tessie Naranjo and Dr. Sue Ellen Jacobs from the Northern Pueblos Institute explain how culture changed in the Pueblos surrounding Los Alamos Laboratories as Pueblo women went to work in the scientists' homes.
Like a potato salad is a big feast fare in the Pueblos for their big feast events. Jello is a big, big thing. Along with the chico soup, the chili, garbanzos. The beans, the garbanzos, all of those things. So we were introduced to these different foods as a result of the wage economy, you know? We were able to buy. And as we moved out from our communities, then we were impacted by what was happening outside. We watched television. We had automobiles to take us here and there. And that also helped influence the changes in our communities.
A lot of the women didn't actually work in the lab. A lot of the women worked in the homes of the scientists who were making the bomb. The men were doing various chores in the lab itself and outside of the lab on the peripheries. But what women brought back was an understanding of the way the scientists and their wives lived and the kinds of material goods that they had and how easy it seemed to be to get those things. As I understand it, women everywhere want to lighten their load when you've got children and you have to cook for everybody and all of that. So if you can shave off a half hour of the day by not having to do the preparation from scratch, as used to be you had to get pozole. If you can buy it in a can that somebody else has done all that hard work for you, that helps a lot.
My pet word, process,
yeah,
is compromised again and again and again. Canned foods, you no longer have to do the corn from scratch.
That's right. So you have that, not only that system of barter, but the obligations, the reciprocity that happens because you help somebody else during their time of need and they help you. So it does more of that fracturing of the extended family into small groups, and who can make the most money and who's got the most stuff begins to appear on the horizon. This is happening all over the country, by the way. It's not just in the pueblos that it's going on, but the whole country is just forgetting the origins of the human community.
And the relationship to the land?
Yes.
And to our opa, the universe? We're losing that.
And maybe very confused on po-eh.
And we're being confused about our path's journey. We are not as intimate with the process, with the understanding of the land, because we are so busy at wage earning.
University of New Mexico anthropologist Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez explains the shifts that occur when people feel that they are losing their land and how that is connected to culture.
I think in a way, in the context of the last several decades, where you have a changing economy, a changing demography, you have a kind of real estate development that has escalated the price of land and has encouraged and will increasingly encourage the separation of surface water or irrigation water from the land. You have people who historically, of course, lost land with the coming of the American system, when a lot of the land grants were lost. And I'm speaking of the Spanish-speaking peoples primarily, who've been in New Mexico for many generations. There's a sense that the loss of the land led to impoverishment, led to displacement, dispossession, leaving the original communities in order to get jobs. So there's a sense that the land was the basis of people's ability to make a living. When they lost the land, they lost the ability to make a living. Of course, the economy was changing anyway. So I think in each successive period of history, there have been different forces that pulled people away from agriculture. In the context of the land grant movement of the 1960s and its aftermath, which was influenced by things that were happening nationally and internationally, as well as by the Chicano movement, land also, as I said, became a symbol of culture, and culture became a way of talking about the land. In other words, people will say, if we lose our land, we will lose our culture. So land becomes a symbol of culture. And so when they say we were losing our culture, in a way they were talking about losing their land. But often they mean by that the traditional life ways that were part of the life in the community, ways of subsisting, ways of irrigating, ways of farming, of taking care of animals, of using the products of their harvest, ways of sharing them, ritual forms, ritual practices, a lot of religious practices, as well as language. All of these things in New Mexico, but I think in places all over the world, land-based peoples feel they are losing, and they're losing them partly because, in many cases, they're losing their land base or their water base, but also because of the forces of globalization, which are really transforming all local economies and incorporating them into a system that's so global in its force that it's changing people's relationships to each other and to the places that they came from.
From my interviews, I see that many land-based people from the various cultures that coexist and create New Mexican culture in the North, the South, the East, and the West all feel this shift of land. Their lives and their culture continue to be affected by the rising costs of living in the land with the outside trends that are pushing in. Culture Bearer and former Lieutenant Governor Roberto Mondragon answers the question, what does it mean to be New Mexican?
To be New Mexican is to be unique, to be a part of something that is different than other parts of the world. Northern New Mexico and Southern Colorado, I believe, should be one and the same. At one point they were, when we were a part of Spain, when we were part of Mexico from 1821 to 1848, and then after the signing of the treaty, then we were, of course, part of the occupation of the United States when the United States came across and implemented Manifest Destiny, saying that God wanted us to come from the Atlantic to the Pacific and took everything in the way, including everything that was Native American, everything that was Spanish American and Mexican American, especially the land. And in doing so, then, there was a big transition. There were people who were opposed to that and certainly did the best that they could to keep it from changing. But naturally, the powers were greater. And so when Kearny came and stood on the plaza of Las Vegas and said, those of you who want to go to where Mexico now is may do so. Those of you who stay will be as American citizens and have the right to their own land, their language and culture and beliefs. And a lot of people stayed. And so those people that stayed then had the problem of adjusting and the problem of dealing with the changes that were going on and the lands that were being lost. The people that went to where Mexico now was, they probably made a bigger statement than anybody else did, even the people that stayed here and participated even in some of the battles. To be New Mexican is to know or to feel or to be a part of this history that includes everything I was talking about. But above that, the uniqueness of your beliefs, the uniqueness of your heritage, the participation in the traditions, many of which have to do with music, los corridos, the traditional colonial music that there was all the way through what's happening now, the different types of music that include singing about places and people and happenings, to eat the foods that are traditional to New Mexico, to live a life that includes very much a part of working with the water and the land to help produce your food. And maybe not even for the purpose of making money, because there's a big difference between doing things because they're your way of life and doing things in order to earn a living.
This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rabbit for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder, associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.